Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan has been a consultant neurologist since 2004. She specialises in the investigation of complex epilepsy, and her first book, It's All in Your Head, won multiple awards. Her latest book, The Age of Diagnosis, draws on the stories of real-life people as well as decades of clinical practice and the latest medical research to ask if medicine has gone too far. And Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan joins me on the line now. Suzanne, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I was very interested to read this book, and part of me thought it was going to be a very medically dense book, and it's not without its research, absolutely, but it's very much fueled by human stories. And you start off with a story that I'm wondering, would you mind telling us about now, about Stephanie and Abigail?
Yeah, so Stephanie is a patient of mine. I've looked after her for a long time now. And I'm a neurologist, and she was referred to me with seizures. Now, after a sort of a certain amount of investigations, I established that her seizures were due to epilepsy, and I began treating them. Not very successfully, I'd say. I wasn't making them better, but we were continuing to try. Over the course of this, we noticed that she was also developing a new problem, difficulty walking. Now, I had no idea what caused her epilepsy, and in the first instance, wasn't sure why she had difficulty walking either. And then a chance remark by her husband dropped in a kind of really big piece of new evidence that gave us a clue to the problem. Her husband said that in school, Stephanie's daughter, Abigail, was teased for having a funny walk. Now, this is the kind of thing, you know, a neurologist trying to unravel a diagnosis loves a piece of evidence like that, because it's immediately saying, hey, this is something that could be in this person's family. There could be a genetic cause for Stephanie's problem. In due course, I referred Stephanie and her daughter, Abigail. Abigail, by the way, was 15 at the time, to a neurology clinic to investigate the possibility this was a genetic cause. And it was discovered that that was the case after lots of tests. They found that both women had a genetic variant, once called a mutation, that explained why they had a neurological problem. Now, I told that story for a very particular reason at the start of the book, because I'm trying to illustrate to people what overdiagnosis is. So overdiagnosis doesn't necessarily mean that a diagnosis is wrong, but rather that a diagnosis is not necessarily an advantage to the person. It's not helping them. Because I've racked my kind of brain for years since that. That was some years ago that happened. And I felt some guilt about whether I did Abigail a disservice. Her mum, Stephanie, my patient, was in her 40s then. She had lots of symptoms and she needed a diagnosis. Abigail was observed by others to have some difficulty walking, but she didn't believe she had a medical problem at that time. And I've worried a great deal since whether I actually helped Abigail by telling her at the age of, you know, as a late age teenager, that she was going to develop a neurodegenerative problem in the future. That's the very definition of overdiagnosis. That is news she could have waited for another 20 years. Some would say that she was lucky because she would never have to sort of wonder what was wrong with her. She wouldn't need lots of tests as her mother had. But I've worried for a long time since, pointing at her body and saying something isn't normal, something you should be worried about it.
And rather incredibly, Abigail went on to work with preschool children, and she likened your exploration to when a small child falls down, depending on our reaction to the fall or if they see blood. It sort of informs the reaction that they have themselves, which is an amazing analogy for what it is you're trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful example. I mean, Abigail put it absolutely beautifully. She said that, you know, if a kid falls down and you point at them and they see blood, they start crying. And I had potentially done something very similar to her. I'd pointed at her body and I'd said, you know, something isn't right there. And what could have happened then is it could have focused all her attention on her body in a negative way. You know, at the time, she just accepted she was a person who wasn't great at sport. You know, she liked yoga, but she wasn't great at running. You know, she wasn't worried about that, was just how she was. But when I pointed at her body and said, you know, there's something genetically wrong here that could get worse, it might have made her feel, completely changed her experience with her body. I'm happy to report, actually, Abigail's an amazing human being. it didn't actually bother her that much at all. But I did not know that when I sent her to a neurology clinic without her realizing she had a medical problem.
And I think it's a very vulnerable place for you to start, where, as you're somebody who's highly qualified with years of clinical experience and study behind you, to say, I worry, have I got it wrong? Was that important that you set that tone? Because it may be viewed as controversial or brave for you to work within medicine and ask these questions.
I think that the difficulty is that, you know, this is the way medicine is going now, is that, you know, we're encouraged to kind of predict diagnosis, to diagnose things at earlier stages, to anticipate future medical problems. And I'm a doctor, full-time work within the NHS. You know, I'm as caught up in that kind of that way of practicing medicine as anybody else. And I, like anyone else, need to examine my own practices and say, you know, is what I'm doing definitely the right thing? Because we have all these assumptions. I think it's terribly well-meaning. You know, the assumption that people want to know their health future, even if it can't be changed, the assumption that diagnosing things early is a useful thing to do. You know, they're well-intentioned assumptions, but I think we have to sit back a little bit now and say, okay, good assumptions, but are they working?
And you say you've noticed a real change over the last 10, 15 years. You're now starting to meet young people who will have a list of diagnoses and labels.
Absolutely. And it was a major driver for writing the age of diagnosis was that, you know, I look after just adults, but very often they're very young adults. They could be people in their 20s. And I see them coming to me with long lists of medical labels that, you know, they wouldn't have had 20, 30 years ago when I qualified as a doctor. So, for example, people will come with autism, ADHD, anxiety, and a variety of other medical labels. And I understand the purpose of many of these diagnoses is try and support these people to live longer, happier, healthier lives. But I don't see that happening. I don't see the corresponding improvement in their health. And I've come to worry that some of these labels may be doing to these people what my diagnosis of a premature genetic neurodegenerative condition could have done to Abigail, that instead of empowering them to live longer, happier lives, we're pointing at a lot of young people and saying, look, this is wrong with you and that is wrong with you, and that's reinforcing their difficulties.
Yeah, it's something I really battled with as a parent of somebody who got a diagnosis, and obviously that was something that I chose to do as the adult. And I did worry about that label. I wanted to make sure that the supports would be there in place, particularly in the education system, and that level of understanding would be there. But I also wondered what that label would do with their concept of what they were capable of. And in a world where, thankfully, we're talking more about neurodivergence, and better than when I was sitting in a classroom, I think it's a really important conversation that you're starting, that we're almost afraid to have.
You know, I really feel for parents and I feel for school children because they're really caught in a difficult situation, because medical diagnosis has become the way to access help for your struggling child. And without a diagnosis, schools can't get extra help or you cannot get extra help for your child. So I feel like parents and young people are often cornered into taking the diagnostic label because it's the only route to help. There's absolutely no doubt that we have a chronic neglect and underdiagnosis problem. I was in school in the 70s, 80s. No one in my class of 120 that I knew of was recognized as having a special learning need, but clearly some people must have. So we're trying to correct the problem, but I fear that correcting it with labels, we're not being mindful enough. It should be possible to recognize a struggling child and offer them support without telling them they have a neurodevelopmentally abnormal brain. And that's really, I'm not advocating for us going, you know, paying less attention to children's struggles or not offering help. I'm advocating offering the help without the label, because it does really concern me at the mild end of a behavioral or learning spectrum that we're, you know, creating kind of self-fulfilling prophecy for a child, that we're saying, you know, you have all these difficulties and they're due to abnormal wiring of your brain. That might lead a child to believe that those problems cannot be overcome, when actually perhaps with maturity, they could be overcome.
there is such a wealth of information out there and misinformation, and that also dilutes the diagnosis in many ways because people are bandying around words such as trauma, trigger, we're all neurodiverse, you know, I'm OCD. They're kind of throwing around these terms, as you say, at the lower end of the wedge, really not thinking about the people who really need the supports.
Yeah, I mean, that's what always concerns me, is that the sort of conversation is trivializing these disorders. These disorders are not trivial, you know, just medical problems or problems like autism and ADHD. If anyone has met anyone with these difficulties in the more moderate or severe range, there's absolutely nothing trivial about that. Children with those sorts of difficulties will struggle to stay in education without support. But I think in public conversation, a lot of people kind of reduce these medical concepts to kind of single traits. So they say, well, I'm not good at eye contact, or I'm not good at, you know, certain social situations. And they consider these kind of singular traits to be enough to indicate that they're on a spectrum in some way. I think what people don't understand is that to be diagnosed with these conditions, you need to have a considerable number of difficulties in different domains, and they must happen in lots of places, at home and school, not just in one environment, and they have to cause impairment. But if you read social media, you would not get the you would not get an accurate view of what autism or ADHD is there, and that conversation really diminishes the very real suffering of these disorders for people who are genuinely affected.
You also talk from a medical point of view how we are moving the goalposts, as it were, for how we diagnose certain conditions. What impact is that having?
Yeah, so that's had a huge impact on the number of people diagnosed. Now, once again, this is really well-intentioned. And my question is, however, is that well-intentioned change working? So if, let's say if you take the example of autism, which, you know, when the concept was created in the 1940s, it was referred to as extreme autistic aloneness, and the people affected were utterly disinterested in other people. You know, they were extreme social communication difficulties. And then in the 1960s, somebody said, hey, maybe these difficulties are in a spectrum and there are people who are more mildly affected. And in the sort of decades since then, there have been multiple small adjustments to what it means to have autism. So older people can get it, and the diagnostic kind of description has changed to include more women. So people keep changing the concept in order to allow the diagnosis in more people. And that's done on the assumption that if, you know, one group is helped by the diagnosis, maybe this other group or this more mildly affected group will be helped also. This is where I have a problem. I'm not saying the diagnosis is wrong in any of these more mildly affected groups. Overdiagnosis doesn't mean a diagnosis is wrong. Where I have a problem is that the more people we diagnose, we are not seeing the downstream positive effects of that. You know, if it was useful to diagnose more and more and more people with autism, we should be seeing happier, better adjusted, older people. So young adults should now be better able to stay in education. Young adults should have better mental health. We're seeing the opposite. You know, we've got a mental health crisis now in young adults and a growing population of autistic children.
We're only really getting to scratch the surface of the book, but there was something that you said at the end. Obviously, with any book like this, you can't be responsible for asking the questions, presenting the information, and then have a chapter on how we fix all of this. That's not, unfortunately, how it works. And in fact, your conclusion chapter is a fairly dense and hefty one. But there was something that really jumped out at me, because you speak about from a societal point of view, from a personal point of view, from a medical point of view, what we can do. But you said something about the wellness world that I've really been rolling around in my head ever since, that we are setting up this level of perfection to be living in a certain way, and that when people don't meet that feeling incredible 100% of the time, they feel there must be something wrong. I think it's a really important thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, there are kind of conversations around just normal differences between people and imperfections, not just, you know, imperfections in mood or, you know, even the way we talk about things like sleep, that you'd be forgiven for thinking that if you didn't sleep exactly 7 hours every night, that something horrific was going to happen to you. But, you know, the nature of sleep is it's a bit different for everybody, you know, and it's the same with aging, you know. As we age, we start getting aches and pains and our memory starts declining very quickly. But we've created this kind of expectation that we should expect a lot of our aging bodies.
It's a brilliant book that asks some very interesting questions. It's called The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, thank you very much for coming on.
And thanks for having me.
I'd love to get your thoughts on what Suzanne has to say. I think particularly if you've ever received a diagnosis, would you have preferred to not know? You can let us know. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you can always send us a voice note to that address too.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.